So this is a joint work with Emily Shen, who unfortunately couldn't make it here, otherwise she'd be presenting the work. I'm a big fan of post-election audits. The work that Philip Stark has done leading the way with risk-limiting audits has been great. This presents a slightly different approach to doing risk-limiting audits. It's very similar in spirit, but the details are different, as you'll see. So we'll talk about post-election audits a little bit to start off with, then talk about Bayesian ballot polling audits, and then Bayesian comparison audits a little bit, give some experimental results, and wrap it up. So what's the point of an audit? The point is to check that the machines have counted the ballots correctly. We assume you've got paper ballots. You'd like to know that the machine is giving the same answer that a full hand count would do. So you confirm to a high degree of confidence that the reported outcome is correct. Either that or you go to a full hand count. Or, more cynically, you want to convince the losers they really lost. Right? That's the whole point of election. Dan said that. I think I've got a quote in the paper from Dan on that point. Yes, right. So we're talking today about single ballot audits, looking at ballots one at a time, checking to see what the ballot type is by hand examination, looking at the actual type and comparing that possibly to the reported type which the machine gave for that ballot. And then at each step, after you look at a ballot, you can decide whether things are looking okay and you've confirmed the reported outcome, or you can stop or you can continue and look at more ballots. And we assume that a full hand count is needed to overturn the reported outcome. So if things aren't looking like they're confirming what the machine said, you better keep looking and really make sure that it's different than the machine said. So in a ballot polling audit versus a comparison audit, a ballot polling audit, you only look at the actual ballot types, what you see when you look at them by hand, and with a comparison audit, you're comparing that to the scan type. So in the ballot polling audit, you look at them. The first one's vote for A, the second one's a vote for A, and that's all the information you have. Whereas with a comparison audit, you're also looking at the reported types, what the machine said for those same ballots. So the reported types are available to you, and you start looking at the actual types by doing your audit one at a time and seeing when you've got discrepancies. The comparison audits tend to be much more efficient in terms of number of ballots you look at because of the high correlation between the reported types and the actual types. So to present the Bayesian approach, let's assume that the high level, you can sort of take the Bayesian mechanism as a black box, which gives you, at any point, a magic box that allows you to answer the question, given what you've seen in the audit so far, what's the probability for each candidate that they would win if you looked at all of the ballots by hand? Right? So you assume you've got a subroutine or a black box that allows you to answer that question. Of course, you can reasonably ask, is that question even well-defined? And that gets into the whole Bayesian philosophy. So what are we talking about here in terms of probabilities? Because somebody did win, or whatever. But we'll put that aside. So assume you had a black box like that. Then, as you look at more and more ballots, things start converging. And when a particular candidate has an apparent or subjective winning probability of greater than 95%, or if the reported winner has got a winning probability greater than 95%, you can stop and say the audit's done. This confirms the machine count. Otherwise, you keep going. So my example here, this sort of looks like the demo I had last night. It'll slightly arrange it differently, I guess. So you've got the actual ballot types, and you're starting off, you don't know anything. The probability that A wins is 50%. Probability that B wins is 50%. You look at the first ballot, and this black box says that, now A has a 75% chance of winning. What does that mean? Well, we'll get to that. But this box is saying, the probability that A is going to win the full hand count is now estimated to be 75%. But second ballot you look at is also for A. The probability goes up to 87.5%. B has gone down to 12.5%. Then we see a ballot for B. So the probability for B goes up, A goes down. And this can oscillate around. We get back to 2 and 2, so it's 50-50 again. And then we see more ballots for A. And the probabilities will converge, get high enough so that, at this point, you can stop and say, we've confirmed the reported outcome, assuming that A was the reported winner before. So that's the flavor. It's a sequential one by one, looking at ballots one after the other. Keep track of the probabilities of winning it as you go along. So how do you make this black box? How do we do the Bayesian computation? So let's consider the simplest case, a very simple case. We've got five ballots in the whole election, two candidates, A and B. We do a random sample without replacement of two ballots, and you see that those two ballots are for A. what are the chances that A won? Well, that's the question we have to answer now, right? We have to have a way of formulating that. Well, to even make that question well-defined, you need to have a prior, you need to put this in a Bayesian framework and say, what's the likelihood of different profiles, different collections of cast ballots? A non-informative prior is the typical Bayesian approach then. That would say that every tally is equally likely. We're not going to put a bias in for particular tallies. We'll say that each of the six possible tallies in this five-ballot election is equally likely. So a tally of 5-0, 5 for A, 0 for B, gets a 1/6 prior probability, as does all the other possible tallies. And then I claim that with this, and I'll justify, that with this prior in the sample we saw of two A's, A wins with subjective probability 95%, so you could stop the audit. So how do we do that computation? Well, that's just Bayes' law, Bayes' rule. The posterior probability of an event is the proportional to the prior probability times the likelihood of getting the data given the prior. In particular, for this case, we've got six possible cases of tallies, 5-0, 5 for A, 0 for B, up to 0 for A, 5 for B. Each had a prior probability of 1/6. It's easy to compute the likelihood, given the tally, of a particular event, like getting two A's. For example, if there's only one A, then there's zero probability of drawing two A's. But if there was three A's and two B's, then the probability of getting the first A is 3 out of 5. And then after you've drawn that card out and you're not replacing it, then the chance of getting the second A is 2 out of 4. So the 3/5 times 2/4 is the likelihood of that event. Bayes' rule says we multiply this times this, so we get the product. So these are the product of those two. You normalize to make them add up to 1. These are the probabilities of those 4 tallies and the posterior probabilities after having seen that sample. And if we look at the cases where A wins, which is the tallies where A is more than B, and here's the probabilities where B wins, we add them up. Well, B thus got a chance of winning of 1 out of 20, which is 5%. And A wins with 95% probability. So that's an example of how the Bayesian computation would work in this case. So this is sort of the long drawn out way of doing this. There's a couple of other ways of doing it that are cute. Now let me illustrate one that I have a particular fondness for because it involves this cute urn model that Polya invented. So Polya said you can compute posterior probabilities using this urn model. So let me describe another way of doing this, which gives you the same. It allows you to sample from the posterior distribution, which is good there. And if I go back to this model, this works for small cases nicely, but it doesn't work when there's lots of candidates and more complicated situations. But the urn model works for quite a, for everything, really. So here's a case. We take a sample of S ballots from an N ballot profile. So N is the number of ballots cast. S is what you've audited so far. You want to figure out how to sample from the profile. So we want a representative profile that this sample could have arisen from. So we, in an urn, a ceramic pot or whatever, we put one A ball and one B ball. We've got two candidates here. So these initial balls correspond to the priors that we have, which is sort of say basically that A and B are the possible candidates, and they're equally likely a priori. This is a non-informative prior. So we get the urn started with that, and you'll see why we need them. And then we have our sample. We have the two A's that we drew out of our election of size 5, say, in this case. So we'll put those in the urn as well. And that's the sample that we drew. And we were talking about election of size 5, so we'll need 3 more ballots to finish up the profile. So we're going to sample now and use a probabilistic procedure, which will generate the rest of the profile in a way that's proportional correctly to the probabilities according to the prior and the likely, given the sample we've drawn. And how does that work? Well, n minus s times n is 5, s is 2, so it's 3 times. Now we're going to add another ball to the urn. We've got an urn with 4 balls in it. 3 of them are for A, 1 is for B. And we just duplicate a ball in the urn that's already in the urn. So we take reach in, grab, randomly grab one. So we make grab an A, and we put the A we grabbed back in, and we duplicate. We put another one in. And so this is a process which fills out the urn. And a very beautiful process, and you get a complete sample then, a complete profile. We're going to delete the balls we added for the prior, and now we've got a complete profile. This sample of size 5 is representative of the kinds of profiles that could generate the sample we had, and it has precisely the right probability distribution according to the Bayesian rules of starting off with the non-informative prior and including the sample that we had. So it's a beautiful little process and gives you a lot of intuition about what's going on. And you just tally what's in the urn now, you've got a tally of 4 to 1. That will generate a profile with the right probability distribution on the tallies you could have had. And then you can figure out, you just do repeat the sampling process, do a Monte Carlo simulation to see who actually wins with what probability. So that's the main idea for the inner loop of this process, for doing the computation, for implementing this black box. There's a slightly more efficient way using gamma variates, which is in the paper, but this is sort of the prettiest one, I think. So there's the implementation of the black box for doing the Bayesian computation. So we now got a way of implementing the Bayesian black box, given a sample, given this non-informative prior. You can compute, or at least closely approximate, the Bayesian probability of a particular candidate winning. You just expand out the sample to a full, take your sample, expand it out this way to a full profile, see who won. You do that many times, and you can say, what are the chances of A winning here? And this will give you actually the 95% chance of A if you actually do that out. And so you see the probabilities evolve over time. You're in a three-candidate race. You might have all of them. Initially, when you've looked at see no ballots, they all have a probability one-third of winning. And then as you start looking at the ballots, things may go up and down as you see ballots for different candidates. This is for a particular actual data set we had. But then the winning candidate will actually have a probability of winning according to this Bayesian measure that goes up to 1. And when it exceeds your threshold, 95 or 97% or whatever, you can just stop the audit and say, yeah, we've confirmed that that's the winner. I'd have to go back and look and see what the data set was. This was a sort of a constructed artificial small data set with 100 ballots or something, I guess. So, yeah. Pardon? It doesn't, as the profile gets large, it doesn't depend much. I mean, if the sample size is close to the whole profile size, if you're sampling half the ballots or something, then it really doesn't matter. But if you're getting, if the profile is more than twice as big as the samples, things like that, it really doesn't matter. You might as well be infinite, pretty much. I mean, so these things tend to be. I mean, they sort of, you converge pretty quickly. In fact, I was wondering if I could prove more about that to speed up the computation. So instead of doing a poll user urn out for 1 million ballots, if you're doing LA or something like that, you just simulate it out to 10,000 or something like that, and it would give you effectively the same answer. But I don't have bounds on that computation yet. So. All right. So, good. So one of the nice things to note about this is what are we doing? We're sampling complete cast vote profiles. We're starting from the sample we took from the audit, and we have a way of growing it with this poll user urn process up to a complete profile. And the only thing that matters here is just you have to look at the ballot and be able to duplicate it. So there's no interpretation needed or anything like this. And these could be any kind of ballots. These could be IRV ballots. These could be approval ballots or whatever. It could have any kind of voting system. So all we need is the ability to sample ballots, to duplicate ballots, so it's easy, and then to be able to run your voting system on the complete profile. So this process, this Bayesian auditing process, will allow you to audit not only plurality elections, but also more complicated things like IRV elections. So you can take on a collection of IRV ballots, take a random sample of them, and then grow the sample out to a complete thing. See, did you get the same winner as the machine count reported? So you can answer that question. So we do board accounts. Schultz, we even played with Schultz method, the beat path method, which is pretty complicated, other things. So it all fits together. So it's flexible that way. It's just like resampling methods and statistics are, really have the same sort of flavor. So this is a method which has flexibility. Now let's talk about comparison audits. I don't really have a whole lot to say here because it's a very simple extension. What did we see before? We had a small sample. We extended it out to a full profile. To do comparison audits, you just do the same thing, but once for each ballot type, for the reported ballot types. So all of the things where the machine count was for A, you separate those ballots off into one category, and all the ones where the machine count was for B, separate those into another category. You do what we just saw before for each of those two subpopulations, and then add the results together. And this allows you to sample from profiles where you're taking advantage of the correlations between the actual types and the reported types. So it all works very smoothly here. You can look at the paper for more details, but it's a natural extension of what you've just seen. You need to be able to match the paper ballots with the electronic records, of course, though, and that's a prerequisite for any kind of comparison-based single ballot auditing procedure. So we did some experiments, and these are experiments that Philip had reported in a couple of cases, so they're real data. The first one was a ballot polling one, the second one's a comparison audit. These are just small samples to sort of say that, is this method in sort of the same ballpark as the risk-limiting audits that Philip's been experimenting with. And so this is a ballot polling audit, ballot polling audit for an election with two candidates, plus write-ins. There were about a couple thousand votes cast. Philip's ballot polling audit had a 10% risk limit. It looked at 89 ballots to confirm that this was the correct result. And with the Bayes procedure, which is doing a separate thing. I mean, we're comparing apples and oranges here, Ben. I'll say a little bit more about that. But you know, a risk-limiting audit and a Bayesian audit are not known to be, at least, the same thing. They're very similar in spirit. The risk limit that Philip talks about and the Bayesian error limit here talk about slightly different things. So they're not quite comparable, but they're spiritually close enough that I think it's not unreasonable to look at similar parameter settings and see how we do here. And here we did, comparable number of ballots. We did a little better here. We were able to run a number of cases and see only 11 ballots on the median needed. But I view these as being fairly comparable outcomes. And the comparison audit, similarly, in the Stanislaus County, there was Oakdale Measure O, which I actually don't know what that was about. Philip maybe can explain that. It was a comparison audit in this case, a yes-no proposition, 3,000 ballots cast, 1,700 yes, 1,300 no. And with the 10% risk limit, the risk-limiting audit looked at 49 ballots. The Bayesian audit looked at 92 on the average and 39 median. There's a fairly high skew on these distributions. So again, comparable kinds of results. So I think the Bayesian approach looks promising. It needs a lot more experimentation, but looks promising in terms of its efficiency with comparison with the risk-limiting audits, at least in these two cases and some of the other experiments we've run. Yes? It's a very long tail, right? So if you were there last night too, right, you could have situations where if you're drawing samples, you can very quickly terminate. If you see a lot of things favoring the machine-reported winner right away, you may stop early. But if you start getting in the cases where you start seeing a number of the other cases, it tends to be a long tail, basically. So this is not a symmetric distribution. Is it? So what's the relationship between Bayesian audits and risk-limiting audits? Well, it actually seems plausible to conjecture, and so we do so in the paper, that Bayesian audits may actually, in fact, maybe with some conditions or counseling factors thrown in, a risk-limiting audit. I don't see anything to contradict that. They're so close in spirit that this very well might be true. It also very well might be false. I just don't know. But I'm happy to throw the conjecture out there for somebody to play with. Maybe we'll be able to prove it. But they give slightly different results technically. But I think they're both good foundations for audits in practice and to study theoretically. I think they give slightly different results, and you should understand the differences. But and they may actually be the same sort of beast if this conjecture could be proven. Also, Bayesian audits admit the use of other priors. You don't have to have a non-informative prior. One of the things, as we said at the beginning, was you want to convince the losers they lost. You can imagine from a Bayesian perspective that someone coming in to look at the audit representing a certain candidate might say, I really believe that all of those ballots that haven't been looked at belong to me. So he's got a prior that's very different from a non-informative, unbiased prior. He says, I should have won that election. And you want to convince him that he lost. You can actually model that nicely within the Bayesian framework and have a prior that represents that sort of very biased point of view. In fact, you can do it for all of the candidates, and you can do all of that simultaneously. So you've got a number of Bayesian audits going all at once, and you only stop the audit when all of these Bayesian audits are happy that the reported winner was correct. All right, so that's sort of a nice feature too. So what are the advantages of this approach? I think it's got good efficiency. The experiments we've run so far seem to be highly efficient. Not too many ballots are looked at. And the miscertification result rates in terms of the observed times that the incorrect result is allowed to pass through seems to be small and controllable, but it's not controllable quite in the same way that the risk-limiting audits provide. It's a Bayesian approach again. It's simple in structure, it's easy to implement. It handles, again, ballot polling audits, comparison audits, and many different kinds of voting systems. No margin of victory computation is required to get started, which is one of the things that you may need with other approaches. You got multiple flexible choices of prior, as I mentioned, and it can be stopped early with meaningful results. You know, if you say, well, if I have to stop because of budget limitations or time limitations, you get some estimate as to how far you've gotten on the audit. Only works for single ballot audits. I don't know how to make it work for precinct-based audits at this point. The relationship with risk-limiting audits is conjectural at this point, as I said, and the results do depend upon your choice of priors, the usual Bayesian issue with the use of priors. And you need a program to compute these winning probabilities, so that's an easy program to write. That's it. And there's a website there with the paper and the slides, and the program that I demonstrated last night is also on that site. Happy to stop for questions.
So we have several minutes for questions.
Yes, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the risk and the ways in which it is or is not controlled. I saw the reference to sequential analysis in the paper, and based on my limited exposure to sequential testing, typically the stopping criteria are set in this non-obvious way to make sure that you've controlled your risk to a certain level. So I'm just a little bit confused about in what respect this does or does not do that.
Right, so this is a Bayesian approach, and so the risk is measured with respect to the prior. And the nice thing about a Bayesian sequential approach is that you can stop at any time and the Bayesian estimates are still valid, so that the stopping rule condition is really orthogonal from the thing. So you can stop at any time, and the estimates that you have as to the risk you're running with respect to the prior you've got. So once you've got accept the prior, saying this non-informative prior is fine with me, I believe it's a conservative estimate of how these things, how to look at these probabilities, then with respect to that, you're fine. With respect to the risk in some other sense, it's not clear again how they relate. That's this conjecture that we talked about. So, but I believe that this approach is a solid approach to auditing in the sense that the Bayesian auditing is used in lots of other aspects too, used for financial auditing in other places. So that the approach of using a Bayesian, choosing a prior and running an audit in a Bayesian way and measuring your risk in terms of what the prior estimates the probability would be. You have to look at the prior and make sure it's reasonable as far as what you're, how you feel about it. But then whenever you stop, it's a Bayesian sequential analysis is actually nicer than a lot of the other the walled sequential analysis things where it does get complicated. I hope that answers your question. I'd be happy to talk at more length about that too. Yeah. It is non-true. This could be sort of complicated, some of it.
I think it's very elegant. I do have some concerns relating to the risks. For example, the networks coming to you and saying, hey, we're in the business of predicting elections before the ballots are finished, before the balloting is finished, which is, I think, a bad practice. But if they come to you and they say, hey, we want you to second guess the other networks which are predicting that the other guy is going to win, you might have some interesting challenges. Now, when you get to IRV, again, you have to wait until everything is in, pretty much. You and I talked about this a minute ago.
Yeah, for any of these approaches, for all of these approaches, you need to have all of the ballots there.
Yeah, I understand.
Well, there are ways of doing reservoir sampling where you can keep a sample as the
So one of the risks is that somebody is trying to get you to use this early on, before you have all the data. And then you have the sampling problem that some late precincts are the ones that
Right.
Okay. So you're just going to eschew anything like that a priori.
Yeah, I mean, I think you want to play a clean game. You want to have all of the ballots understood ahead of time, and say I'm going to be sampling from this universe of ballots.
Right. So it's really post hoc auditing.
I mean, I think you could probably approach a situation where the size of the universe was actually unknown at the beginning and make it work that way, but I don't want to get into that at this point.
Okay, good. So, thank you.
In a comparison audit, how do you police the match between the recorded and the actual voter intent? Is that a batch process or what's
so,
the?
So Philip is better able to answer this question than I am. He's had a lot of experience with doing that. But I mean, you need to have some
you
way.
Just did it last week.
I was happy to help you out in Napa with that. But you need to have some way of making sure every ballot has a unique identifier, basically. So, and you can find the paper ballot that's got that identifier, or at least maybe it's a position in a particular labeled box, say. So ballot number 3 and box number 2456. So it's got a way of getting the paper and getting the corresponding electronic record. Once you've got both of those in hand, then you can say, are they showing the same result?
Right.
So the key step is making sure that you haven't lost track of that correspondence between the image of the ballot or the cast vote record. So you've got to have an identifiable electronic record for every paper ballot, and the correspondence
right.
between the paper ballots and the electronic records has to be maintained, and you have to be able to pull them together. So you sample, and you have a process for sampling from this universe, and that's a whole other thing I didn't talk much about, but you can use some cryptography and some dice and things like this to have a nice pseudo-random process.
So in the samples that you showed me, was that identifier different on those ballots depending on what county you were dealing with, or...?
The ones that we looked at had a random sampling process that was we knew how many ballots there were. We just sort of picked in a pseudo-random manner a sequence of ballot indices within the total number
right.
of things. So you got from 1 up to N, say, well, the first one is going to be 25 and then 96, and it's all generated in a cryptographically secure pseudo-random way.
Thanks. Thanks,
yep.
Mike.
Yep.
Let's thank Ron again.
Thanks.